Let's get to somebody who is in South Africa again for the first time in a little while, but he is one of my favorite people when it comes to talking about South African politics, global politics, what's happening in the US, and he's very well placed to do all of this. He is none other than the terrific Colonel Chris Wyatt. Ta-da! There he is.
Good morning, Gareth. How you doing?
I'm extremely well. Nice to see you, Colonel. What's been happening? How are you?
I'm knackered.
Where have you been?
I apologize for a cough if it comes up. I picked up something a few weeks back. No, I've been all over. Started in Western Cape, and from Cape Town, I went to Strand, to Hermanus, to Hansbaai, Stanford, Swellendam, Riversdale, Mossel Bay, George, Knysna, P.E., Chafranet, Oranje. After 6 years of being pestered to go there, I finally went to Oranje. And I was terrified. It's so frightening. These people are scary there. They walk around the streets and the kids play. It's horrible. From there, I went further down south. I was at Beaufort West and then Worcester. After Worcester, it was on to Wellington at Western Cape. And then I came up to Joburg and I went down to Nelspruit, Mbombela. I haven't been there in 25 years, so it was nice to see that from there.
I just got to say, just the way you are the only American who's pronounced every single place in South Africa absolutely perfectly. I was expecting at least one screw up there, and you didn't do one badly.
Would you like me to say Lesotho as well?
No, you do Lesotho very well. It's President Trump who goes Lesotho.
Well, you know, that's how it's spelled, so it's understandable that the Normans screwed up the pronunciation of our language. My ancestors arrived in 1066, and it all went sideways.
So let's just talk about a couple of things, because I do want to touch on as many of these as possible while we've got you on the show. And, of course, you can follow Colonel Chris Wyatt on all of his social media. He's constantly putting up amazingly interesting, insightful stuff about the South African international relations with other places. He knows about the internal politics of South Africa. He knows about parties in this country, the leaders of parties, the policies of parties. He pays attention to this stuff. And to give you a very brief little bit of background, I mean, you were posted in South Africa for a while during probably the most interesting period in our history. So you know a lot more than many of the local commentators will let on. And of course, you're also very good at giving us some insights into what happens in America.
Well, I certainly try. I was never actually stationed in South Africa, but of course I had duties that brought me here frequently in official business while still serving the army. But I was stationed and lived in Tunisia, Liberia, Botswana, Malawi, Niger, Mauritania, Uganda, and Ethiopia, as well as having worked at the Africa Command up in Germany and many other things. But so I spent a little bit of time in Africa. So it's a place I know a little bit about. If I could, very quick, Gareth, your previous guest, yes, the Russell 2000 small caps has been pummeled by the S&P 500 large caps, and he gave the exact reasons why. Normally, in a normal marketplace, small caps are a good investment if you want lots of growth, has been the case. And I'll have to chat with them. I think I have a bone pick with them. I wouldn't call South African emerging market. I would call it an imploding market, but that's just me.
Okay, well, let's just talk about something that has been in the news a lot lately, and I know you've been talking about this, is the fight against the Expropriation Act, which has been happening in the Western Cape High Court. A number of parties, including the Free Market Foundation, AfriForum, the Democratic Alliance, they've all been supposedly going against this. Democratic Alliance, you've got to kind of look at from two points of view, because the Minister of Home Affairs, who's meant to be implementing this, is Dean McPherson, I think. And he has said, no, the expropriation bill, nil compensation is perfectly valid. Everyone else is arguing, we all know what nil compensation is. It's zero. It means you get nothing. It's basically the government, the state, taking your property. And the president, his lawyers have pretty much said exactly that this is full-on state-controlled communism. Whatever you have and we need, we will take from you.
Well, Dean McPherson, the Minister of Public Works, is actually on record as saying that nil means something. Right. No, it means something. He said it means something. I don't know what it means, but it means zero. I looked the word up in the dictionary many times, whether it's Merriam-Webster or it's the Oxford Dictionary. It means nothing. And it's a clear contravention of Section 25 of South Africa's constitution. Mind you, of course, we both know, and for the audience, many know, but some don't, this is a constitution drafted, promulgated, enacted by a majority black government after the apartheid era. They put this in place to put fair and equitable compensation for property. And that's another thing. People need to be very cognizant of that, Gareth. I mean, I've been telling people for 6 years, ever since this thing was introduced in 2018, that this isn't about land. Land is a red herring. Yes, land is something people want to take. But the reality is that this is about property. That could be your retirement funds. That could be your bank accounts. And as I've said all along, and I was at the Western Cape High Court that week for the hearing on a few of the days listening to it. What I've said is that the problem with this is that this law, which Ramaphosa signed in Davos, but he'd actually signed in December, and that way it prevented one third of the members of parliament from signing in opposition to it. Because under your constitution, if one third of the members of parliament object to a law within the first 30 days once it's enacted, it must automatically go to the Constitutional Court for review. And it was circumvented because he signed it actually in December. And by the time he did the big press signing in Davos, it was 34 days and we'd circumvented the constitution. So this law is especially promiscuous because it gives authorities at the national level, which is the norm when you have expropriation or if we have eminent domain in the U.S., national, at the provincial, and at the local level. A local politician, Andile Lungisa, if he's not busy breaking jugs over your head, could steal your property and not have to explain it to you. Essentially, that's what this boils down to at some point. It's pretty frightening. And I don't know how the case went. I've got feelings it went good and bad.
Yeah, well, it's not over yet, and there's much work ahead. I also heard Martin van Staden saying the other day that this is also not the end. If they lose this case, the parties who are contesting it, there are other things. And obviously, every expropriation can be taken to court on its merits. And the goal there would be that these organizations would get behind everyone who did take the government to court for an unfair expropriation. And eventually, they'd keep losing these things until it became too onerous for them to even try and implement the law. That ultimately is the final barricade that people can put up. But, you know, it's just, I mean, private property, Chris, let's just talk about this for a second, because it goes down to what is yours, what you've worked for, what you've already paid tax for in order to have and to own and to have written down in your name as your property. This is the basis of every economy in the world. If you don't own anything, then how do you make more? How do you borrow? How do you start a business? What's the point of starting a business if the proceeds of that business, should you do well, don't belong to you?
Well, it's a fair point, and it's a moral point. I mean, it's a question of morality. Who's moral? But here's the bigger question. It is a massive killer of entrepreneurialism. It is a massive killer of direct investment. People are not going to invest in a place when it's going to be taken from them. That's one of the major impediments for what's happening in South Africa right now. Many foreign direct investors, particularly Americans, are sitting on the sidelines, curious about what's going to happen. If I come in, either I have to give one third of my equity to somebody because they have a better tan than I do, or I have to worry that someone's going to expropriate my property. It's insane. This is what the Soviet Union did. It collectivized, it took the farms, and then it killed 12 million Ukrainians and so many others. This is evil on so many levels, and there's no reason for it. There's no reason for this. This is a lie. The whole thing is a canard. Because here's the bottom line. The government has acquired millions of hectares of land from willing buyer, willing seller, and they've failed to distribute it. And the land they have distributed, they've given to people without giving them extension services, without giving them credit, without giving them any training, without anything. And so they fail by and large. Most of the commercial black farmers, small scale and large scale, who've succeeded since the land redistribution program began in the late 1990s have done so because the white commercial farmer neighbors have helped them get a start, and they've worked well with them. And this is a story that the media never tells you. They never tell you. Anytime white people help black people in South Africa, they're nothing but lies. And I'll tell you, that's exactly what's been happening here. There's so much land the government is sitting on that is just sitting and laying fallow that's misused. And, you know, you talk about the money. That's a good point. People will be able to sue. That's true. But people who own farms, people who own property, you know, this is going to be, and this is the one thing I didn't hear argued in the court, because I don't think it's a matter of law, but it is a matter of politics. I'll tell you that. This law will be used to silence critics of the government of the day, regardless of who's in government.
Of course.
They will have a tool at their disposal. The moment you speak up against them, they'll cancel your credit card, they'll shut your bank accounts down, and you'll starve.
Yeah, and the point is proven also by the fact that this is not to help ordinary black people who are trying to get ahead and want a piece of land to be able to subsistence farm. Just this week, there was a story published about Supra Mahumapelo, who used to be the premier of the Northwest, who owns something like, I don't know, 18 to 24 properties. And clearly, this is the kind of guy who would benefit from this because he's a comrade and the comrades get to help themselves first. And whatever the scraps are that are left are given to one or two people who are related to those comrades. So the ordinary person, the ordinary hardworking, struggling person who lives in a South African township or rural area is going to get nothing from this. They're not going to win.
Well, the question is, how long do we have to try something before we believe it doesn't work and consider that maybe it's a failed concept? Broad-based black economic empowerment is racist, it's immoral, and it's failed. And we've had 30 years of this nonsense, nearly 30 years, that a couple more years, a decade or so more, and it will be as long as apartheid was a system in South Africa, and that failed. So how long do we have to know that this is a failure? I mean, it's just ridiculous. There are three times as many black South Africans living in abject poverty in 2026 as there were in 1994. That's all you need to know. And GDP growth, that's why I said it's not an emerging market, it's an imploding market. GDP growth this year is projected to be 0.5. And that's even before Iran got involved in the oil prices going up and down. It'll probably be less than that. Population growth is over 1%. Inflation is at 3 or 4%. This is an economy that is in contraction. It's shrinking.
All right. So you talk about bad ideas. That how many times do we have to try something before we realize it's a dumb idea? And we'll come back to South Africa, but I got to go to New York because New York has just elected a bunch of communists into Congress, and we've got a communist mayor in New York. And it's not, I'm not being hyperbolic by saying these people are communists. They tell you themselves that they are. It's in every speech and every policy document, and in policies they're actually enacting there at the moment. You got Mamdani opening state-run grocery stores, city-run grocery stores in New York. They are talking about essentially confiscating property. There's a new tax he's brought in, which is being challenged at the moment, which will anybody who owns more than one property in New York on your second property, you will be taxed at a much higher rate. He's been publishing lists of rich people, which essentially is what the Soviets did when you want to go after the owning class. And this has got people in New York very upset, but there are idiots voting for these guys in America. So you talk about dumb ideas carrying on in South Africa. It happens in America too, and it's very disturbing.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that it happens in America, and I'll tell you why. Unconstrained migration for people who come to America refuse to accept the mores, values, and norms of Americans. They produce offspring who are privileged to go to elite schools like Al Sayed did in Michigan and have profited immensely from the capitalist system, free market, and free enterprise, and free speech, and then they betray it with their broken third world ideas that their parents have inculcated with them as youth. And then they try to destroy America from within. That's one part of it. The other part of it is, as I've warned South Africans and encouraged South Africans in the municipal elections of 2021, when I interviewed 7 political party leaders and 45 candidates in South Africa, go to the polls. The reason why these idiots are getting elected is because voter turnout is low. Municipal elections are just like in U.S. is in South Africa. Nobody rocks up. When 31% of the people vote, it takes very few votes to put a retard into power. And that's what's happening in America. And here's the other thing. Well, it's true. It takes very, very, very few votes. Look, if you have 8,000
eligible, I'm not disagreeing. I just think it's right. I think it's that I'm laughing.
Yeah. If you have 8,000 eligible voters in a municipality, say in South Africa, we'll say South Africa because I'm here, and only 4,000 rock up the vote, then you only need 2,001 votes out of 8,000 to be in charge. It's not rocket science. Yet South Africans are apathetic, especially white South Africans. Oh, my vote doesn't count. It does. Get out and do something. The only problem you have in your democracy is you don't get to vote for the candidate. You got to vote for the party. But yeah, New York is, and what's happening in Minnesota, but there's a clapback. This lunatic Francesca Hong, who is on the verge of becoming the governor of Wisconsin, has been beaten back barely by a strong comeback from a candidate that only entered the race 4 weeks prior to the election. So this guy came and he beat her by 4,000 votes, I think it was, out of almost 800,000. And so Wisconsin may have saved itself. And you know what? In this case, I don't care if the Democrat is elected to the Senate because the guy's a moderate. I'm not about Democrats, Republicans. I'm about, you know, the middle of the road and slightly conservative. So, but yes, America, we've got our own problems as well. And it comes to electing retards. We're just as dumb as other people.
Well, speaking of retards, our former Minister of Higher Education, former Minister of Science and Technology, former Minister of Foreign Relations, Naledi Pandor, was on a podcast this week with a guy, Mbui Senindlozi, who was at the EFF before this, and he started becoming an influencer and content creator because it's a much better job than being a politician. Anyway, on his show, she said this week, she said a lot of things, and much of what she said was quite smart and sensible. And, you know, this is always the case that people will say a few clever things and then they'll throw in one stupid and bizarre and ridiculous thing. She said, among other things, that AfriForum and Solidarity, who've built and are building, I went to see the site where they're building this enormous campus in Pretoria, an independently funded, privately organized university, a tertiary education institution in South Africa, which I have no doubt will become the best university in the country. They're building one in Paarl as well. These are guys who have, they've found the funding themselves. It's not government money, and they will have probably about 5,000 to 6,000 students when they're running at full capacity by 2028. And she says it's unacceptable. That was her word that she used. Unacceptable that this kind of thing exists. It's that mindset that I was talking to Ben about earlier. You have makers, according to David Friedberg, and you have takers. And she just cannot, because she's not a maker, she cannot conceive of people organizing and self-funding and putting together something as enormous as a university, because she only sees these things as being possible when the government does them and when people like her have control over the resources that make these things happen.
Well, that's a very interesting take on your part there, Gareth, and I won't disagree with it, that she's a statist and believes the state's there, but I also believe that she's a bit of a race hustler, and this has a lot to do with the fact that it's Afrikaans. So academia already exists. Yeah, they already teach. I've been to their campus. They're using a hotel for the moment while they build the new campus. I'm still waiting for that invitation as a guest lecturer. I guess it's going to be a long wait, but so I'm waiting to see that go up. Well, I mean, I don't speak Afrikaans quite fluently enough to maybe they'll let me lecture in English, but or maybe even German or French. But no, this is disturbing that a person with that much influence, even though the dim star, Naledi, Tswana for star, the dim star that she is not in the ascendance in the ANC because she's been a lifelong cater, like a locust eating from the public trough and accomplishing virtually nothing. This is the same woman who called Hamas and gave them a congratulatory phone call after they murdered 1,200 people, civilians. And of course, the Jew haters will say, well, they were just Israelis. No. They were Christians, Muslims, Jews from all over the world. They tortured and murdered Filipinos. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. They killed Pakistanis. They killed people from all over the world at this festival. And she called them and congratulated them. She also is the person that went to Tehran. And then I don't know if there's any link, but gee, you know, the ANC couldn't pay their party planner 102 million rand, plus had 46 million in fines from the court. And they also had their upcoming 112th birthday party, which cost them 20 million to bus people into Nelspruit. And on top of that, they had an election campaign coming up, which they probably spent at least a half a billion rand on. And magically, after not being able to pay their employees for 18 months for the second time, she goes to Tehran, comes back, and suddenly the court case is settled. A few days later, the 102 million rand is paid off, although I understand they didn't get the money. I don't know if they ever did get it. The point is, this is a woman who says the most outlandish things. She was barred from the United States. I'm not sure why. I think it was because she made some kind of anti-American speech or something like that, or pro-Palestine. I'm not sure. But she has a long history of saying strange things. But look, she's not an idiot. She is a smart person. And I think that she's doing this intentionally. It's part of an effort, in my view, to antagonize, belittle, demean those who speak Afrikaans in this country. And I find it shocking and disappointing. People live in this country, speak multiple languages, they have multiple cultures. And the whole idea is they get to live together in harmony. And if someone wants to take their private funding and get an academic institution accredited, well, that's their business as long as it's accredited and meets the standards that's supposed to for education. The Solidarity already has SolTech, which is a technical school. SolTech is for anyone who speaks Afrikaans. Anyone can go there. I've been there. There have been coloreds and Indians that go to school there that speak Afrikaans, and they teach plumbing, electricity, masonry, stuff like that. That's, you know, academia would be the same. So what is her problem? Stellenbosch, the land was granted under the proviso that into perpetuity, the medium of instruction will be Afrikaans. But Stellenbosch has been abusive and disrespectful and condemned Afrikaans-speaking students in what was the best-known Afrikaans higher institution of education on the planet. And now if you don't speak English, you're treated like a third class citizen there and abused. So if these people want to do it privately instead of a state institution, it's frankly none of her business.
That's a very good point. You mentioned Iran, and I do want to touch on this briefly because it's now well over 6 months that, it's just over 6 months that America has been engaged with Iran in what some people are calling a war, some people are saying not a war. But Iran is not going to be sending money anywhere because they don't have any money anymore. They don't have any military assets to speak of. And on paper, they're a failed state and they're finished. They can no longer fund their proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah. They do not have an air force or a navy to speak of. Their leadership are living underground in hidden locations, skulking around trying to save themselves because they've lost so many of their own cohort. And yet in America and in the rest of the world, because of things like the oil price, this is a hugely unpopular war. How long do you think Trump can weather the storm? What effect do you think this is going to have on the midterms? And do you have any other comments on Iran?
Well, this is one where President Trump and I part company on his strategy and Central Command strategy on how they fought this war. I think it was very brain dead in how it's been done. What should have been done is before anything landed, any missiles, anything hit target, steel on target, there should have been SEALs or Delta Force landing at Karg Island and securing the island, followed by a Marine Expeditionary Unit landing there, or a Ranger Battalion flying in and air defense systems put up, and then the bombs should have started falling all over Iran. The reason Iran has been able to last this long is because we foolishly allowed them to ship oil through the Strait of Hormuz from Karg Island. They made billions and billions and billions of dollars, which kept them alive, gave them a lifeline. So I hope that, in fact, they're out of money. But the problem with a cornered beast is that's when they're most dangerous. When you corner a beast, they're most dangerous. And while Iran may not have the assets it once had, it does have the ability to cause chaos around the world. And that's part of the problem. You know, in the U.S., it's unpopular because people say this is a war of choice. But these people are brain dead. They can fall into the category of retards and people that don't know history. We have been at war with Iran since 1979 when they attacked our embassy and declared war on us. The fact that we didn't participate in the war didn't prevent thousands of American citizens, civilians, and service members from being kidnapped, murdered, tortured, or blown up by terrorists sponsored or funded by Iran all over the world for the past five decades. We have been at war. The fact that a president finally recognized we're at war and decided he had to do something is refreshing. However, my strategy would be very different. And I think that Iran will remain a dangerous threat. The thing is that there's a big narrative, and the media's been spreading this, Trump did this because Netanyahu made him do it. Do you really think Trump will do anything because somebody made him do it? These people are not very bright. The guy knows how to succeed. He knows how to make money. I mean, he's selling his Doge, his coin, selling his Trump coin, made all kinds of money. Yeah, his Trump coin, made $1 billion off that. You know, the guy is not stupid. You know, he's got his Truth Social, which quite frankly is kind of a lame platform, but it's made lots of money, his social media company. You know, it is. Yeah. I mean, I have an account on there, but I mean, I only go there to watch Trump's tweets. You know, that's the only reason I watch it. Because, you know, unless you're famous, you don't have any followers on there because they don't really promote anything. But the point is that Iran has been a problem. And, you know, these Americans are like, well, Iran's not a threat to us. What are they going to do? They can bomb Israel. Well, that's pretty callous. You know, they bomb Israel. If they bomb Israel with a nuclear weapon, then they irradiate the entire Middle East. And, you know, we've got a problem there. But that's very stupid thinking. It doesn't require an intercontinental ballistic missile to deliver a nuclear weapon. You simply put it on a cargo ship and sail it up the Chesapeake Bay and detonate it at the port of Baltimore and destroy Baltimore, D.C., and Philadelphia in one fell swoop. You kill over 3 million people, and America has to go into continuity of government from the bunkers. I mean, these people have no – I mean, do they not watch Hollywood? So, I mean, Hollywood's killing stuff like
no,
this.
No, sure. I mean, to me, this everything you've said makes perfect sense, and I do agree with your strategy rather than the one that they employed. But the only chance Iran has, and this is the substrate layer of what's really going on here. The only opportunity that country has under its current regime to continue existing, and they're betting everything on this. And that's why I agree with you that they're a dangerous animal because they're backed into a corner. But if they can influence the midterm elections and Trump becomes a lame duck because the Democrats take over and the focus shifts, then that is the only lifeline they have. So they probably have an interest in pulling some kind of October surprise and upsetting the whole apple cart because that is survival for them. Everything else, they're pretty much finished.
I agree 100% with what you say, Gareth. It's a great, you agree with me, I agree with you. I think we're both spot on our analysis here. That is the point. And that's the whole thing. I said that as long as this was over by the 4th of July and the 250th celebration of America's independence, that this would wind up in the end being very popular, even though prices of energy spiked, they came back down. But Trump had to get it done by July 4th. Otherwise, it will be a drag on the midterms. And in fact, it will be that. And now we see these Democratic Socialists of America, you know, masquerading in the Democratic Party, coming to ascendancy in places like Minnesota and New York. You know, these are the people at their Democratic Socialist Convention 2019. Point of personal privilege, point of personal privilege. Please stop clapping. I have sensory overload issues. Then next person, point of personal privilege. Please stop waving your hands. Oh, good gosh. Oh my gosh. Comrades. Anyway. Yeah. That's watch the video. It's on YouTube. It's comical.
I know.
Anyway, these people are on the ascendancy because people don't think these things are true. But yes, I believe you're right. That's what they're trying to string it out. It's like playing defense. You know, you get a big lead in rugby and you get lazy, sit back and let them score, but you know, slow the clock run out eventually. And that's what they want. It will affect the midterms. Now we're basically almost a midterm season. By the time you get to September, it's almost too late. Rarely can you make a major change.
I'm gonna make a prediction because this is definitely a minority of point of view. But I don't think the Democrats will win the midterms. I think most of the Democratic Party has moved so far to the left that they're on an 80-20 issue. They're in the 20s, and we know that the Democratic Party at the moment is unpopular even among Democrat registered voters. And I think a lot of people are going, well, you know, we don't like all the spending in Iran. We don't like us being involved in another war, even though it hasn't led to troops being landed on the ground. What they're going to say is, even though all of that is happening, the alternative and these communists who seem to be taking over the Democrat Party, these guys are much worse, and sensibility will prevail. I think that the Republicans will hold on to many of the seats that they've got at the moment. They'll probably add a few.
Well, I'm not disagreeing. Again, I'm not predicting the Republicans losing either the House or the Senate. I am saying that it has affected the election. That's let these Democratic Socialists rise. But that's in the crazy places. It's not going to happen in places like central Pennsylvania or Florida. Excuse me. or Texas. No, it's not going to have a place like that. So it is going to have an impact on the election. But no, I don't think that they're going to lose because, as you said, the Democrats are unpopular. And I think that the canary in the coal mine was this race in Wisconsin for governor. I really think the Democrats are panicking now because she had a 22-point lead on this guy a month before the election when he entered it. And in less than a month, he destroyed her lead and won the election as a moderate Democrat, a Zell Miller, a Joe Lieberman Democrat, and he's a black guy to boot, you know, so he's got it all going for him, you know, so I think that is a better indicator of what's actually happening than the more recent, the ones we had in the recent past of primaries. But there will be hard fought races. There will be a few incumbents that will probably fall because of what's been happening in Iran. But I think that the Republicans are likely to retain. In fact, until July 4th, I thought the Republicans were actually going to gain a few seats in the House because of the redistricting, which I also saw their issue, and I have a problem with that. But I think that they're going to hold their ground in the House, and they're not going to lose. They might even pick up a seat or two in the Senate. The Democrats think they're going to pick up a seat or two. So at the end of the day, Trump will not be a lame duck president. And even if he is, there's not a lot they can do except, you know, start impeachment hearings against him. But that's going to be a distraction. Trump will continue the war. And hopefully, you know, we just start bombing these people in the Stone Age because – you know, this needs to end. Too many people. They killed 40,000 of their own people just a few months ago.
Yeah. I mean, you're so right to give the context of five decades of this going on. And just because America didn't choose to act, now that they are, it's becoming an issue. Let's just talk about South African-American relations, because that's been a very hot potato since Cyril went to the Oval Office and was shamed in front of the whole world. And I don't know if you've met the American ambassador to South Africa, Brent Bozell. But what is the state of play there at the moment? I know that relations between Washington and Pretoria are kind of fraught. You would have some insight in this area as well. What can you tell us?
Cyril went to the White House? I must have missed this.
Ages ago. Yeah, it feels like an age. But, you know, I think the memory of that has stung as well. And, you know, no one in the world, no human being wants to be humiliated. And essentially what happened there, regardless of whether or not you agree with the issues that he brought up about farm killings and many of the other things. It was an embarrassing situation for our president, who sat there with a mouthful of teeth and had to be defended by captains of industry and golf players.
And John Steenhuisen.
And John Steenhuisen, yeah, who's gone. He's no longer important.
Not yet. He'll be shuffled off of some ambassadorial post that hasn't happened yet, but I'm sure we'll hear it announced sometime in the near future. Maybe sure. He'll go to Tahiti as the ambassador. Oh, look, I did, of course, watch that. I was eating popcorn. I had 50,000 people watch my live broadcast for that day. It was embarrassing, but I say, you know, they all tried to say it was a setup. It wasn't a setup. They begged for that meeting. Trump rearranged his schedule to meet with Ramaphosa to deal with this issue. And when he showed up, he lied to President Trump. You know, when they showed the crosses, the white crosses in Normandy, where Glenn and Vita Rafferty were murdered, and those crosses represented people who had been killed on farms, not grave sites. That was a misstatement by Trump. You know, his people write his notes better, get smacked in the head. But it was, you know, they represented actual people. And then the whole story got distorted. And the two things came out of that is that when I can't think of her name right now, the South African, Annika Larson, I think her name is, she asked the question, President Trump, now that President Ramaphosa is here, do you still believe in a white genocide in South Africa? And his response, which no journalist has reported, a handful maybe, but not popular press, not the mainstream media. His response was, he paused, he leaned in with his hands clasped, and he said, I'm not convinced of that. That's what he said on white genocide. Yet they completely ignore that. So look, they weren't set up. If Trump wanted to set Ramaphosa up, there would have been videos of Ramaphosa saying stupid things about America and insulting Trump. But what he did is he used videos of Malema and Zuma, former members of the ANC, currently not in the party. So it actually was, I thought, kind of generous and kind. And that context is never spoken about either. He intentionally did not embarrass Ramaphosa. But Ramaphosa embarrassed him. Mr. President, have they told you where this is at? And oh, come on. You never seen it. I was 9,000 miles away. I watched it unfold live when that funeral procession took place. And there's a big sign at the end. It said, Mr. Ramaphosa, everybody in South Africa saw that. I mean, people in Northwest Province that haven't had water in 3 years saw that. Give me a freaking break. So they embarrassed themselves. Okay. The state of relations. This is all by the ANC, an attempt since last year to say, well, it's all Trump. It's all Trump. It's nonsense. This breach in the relationship between the United States and South Africa began with the Rome Statute, Article 98 waiver, which South Africa initially refused to sign over 20 years ago, putting our service members who came here to do training exercises and assist the South African military and for the FIFA World Cup in 2010 at risk of being arrested erroneously by being here because they would not sign Article 98 waiver, which allows under the Rome Statute to exempt people from arresting people from other countries that might be considered for charges. That started it. Then the 70% tariffs against our poultry in violation of the World Trade Organization, the training of Chinese combat test pilots about NATO flying tactics by NATO pilots and Americans in South Africa, the shipping of our sensitive software and training systems to Beijing with the government's knowledge. The list goes on and on. I have talked about this.
Well, I mean, there's another thing which people aren't talking about, and that is Iran's nuclear program. South Africa may have helped them. We know that the Iranians have been very involved in what used to be our old nuclear site of Pelindaba. It's now usually used for research purposes only. But we know that the Iranians may have had some of the uranium provided by us. And that should be a much bigger issue. I think we're toying with some dangerous foes here. If we make an enemy of Donald Trump and of the Americans in general, we're doing a very stupid thing.
Well, on that note, I would be less worried about enriched uranium and more worried about the possibility of South African nuclear scientists rocking up in Tehran. Now, has South Africa, you know, either government sponsored or privately supported Iran's nuclear program? I can neither confirm nor deny that statement. I don't work for the government, but you can read what you want into my statement I just made. I can neither confirm nor deny that may have happened. And you think if that did happen, the U.S. government wouldn't know about it? Come on.
Of course they would. This is a point that so many people just miss as well, is that, you know, the big software companies that install every piece of technology, hard and software, onto your phone are all run in America. And if the U.S. government has reason to believe that a certain person needs to be paid attention to in digital terms, they can figure out exactly what's going on anyone's phone. And all of our government ministers use their phones as their primary means of communication. That's what every human being does. These guys are on their phones the whole time. We can see, the Americans can see those WhatsApp conversations. They can see what's being posted. They can see all of this stuff.
Well, I worked at the National Security Agency in a major program when I was there as Cyber Command was being established. I can neither confirm nor deny that the United States has the ability to do that.
Yeah, but basically every time Fikile Mbalula sexts somebody, then you know the guys in Washington know about it.
Well, here's the other side of this too. The South African government, to my knowledge, I could be wrong. I'll stand on correction, or sit on correction. And by knowledge, I believe they use almost entirely Chinese technology for their servers, for their email servers, Huawei, and things like that. Do you think that Beijing doesn't have a hammer lock on every communication? Yeah, and so if you say something or do something that is not popular with Beijing, would you be surprised if Mr. Wang makes a phone call or shows up when you're having coffee with someone, you know, in an upscale cafe in Cape Town or Pretoria? Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be surprised at all. You know, when I was at the African Union, I told people, you know, they would want to have a meeting and talk. We're not talking secrets. We're just talking about, you know, how it helped assist, you know, like with the Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone and Liberia, that mission, which we played a role in, but also other things like peacekeeping in Somalia. I would meet with officials and talk about that. And they want to meet at the African Union headquarters. I'm like, no, it's a lovely building, but we can't meet there. Why not? It's a private. It's not private. Every room has cameras. Every room has microphones. The Chinese installed all these. And I was told I was crazy. I didn't know what I was talking about. 2 years after I left the African Union, it was publicly exposed that the reason why no one goes to the top floor of the African Union building, only the Chinese technicians who are still there years after they built the building, is because they have the access and no one else, not even the secretary, can go up there. And they also had a ban outside by the entrance of the building, perfectly placed so they could observe people coming and going into the African Union, every person. So listen, the Chinese are a sovereign state. If they want to spy on people and not get caught, that's their business. But if you're doing business in Africa and you're doing business with Chinese, you should be cognizant of the fact that everything you say and do is being monitored and it could be used against you. That's why the Chinese get such great deals in Africa, because they know everything, every bargaining position the Africans have, because they heard them say it at the African Union when they're talking about, well, we're going to put a united front up. We're going to negotiate for this. And then the Chinese, you come and they know what you're going to do, so they can counter it and they're prepared for it. You just, people just, they blithely think their communications are private. They're not. They're simply not.
What are your thoughts on the upcoming November municipal elections? Do you have any? What do you think of the candidates that have been proffered by various parties? There seems to be a little bit of momentum building up, certainly in the big metros. Do you think we're going to see upsets, big changes, or do you think it's more of the same?
Well, the odds are, if I was a betting man, and I don't bet because that's a fool's errand, the odds are things won't change. I mean, that's been the trajectory. Even as the ANC has lost votes, they've just gone to other parties. They're just as crazy and behave in the same fashion. But I do have a sense of traveling around South Africa that there is something in the air. Listen, when Helen Zille was the mayor of Cape Town, I repeatedly said that she was the best mayor on the planet. She's absolutely amazing. The energy, the drive, what she did in that town. And as a leader of the party taking over from Tony Leon, I thought she built the DA into what could become a colossus, but that was the apex of the Democratic Alliance in 2014. It's been on the downward trend ever since then. And no matter how many lies John Steenhuisen tries to tell us about having gained more votes, that's the lie. They got a higher percentage because nobody showed up to vote. Everybody lost votes. The ANC lost 1.5 million votes in that last election. Look, I think that in some places we're going to see some real surprises. The DA thinks they're going to do well, and I think that they're going to get smacked in the head in places like Cape Town. I think the DA, and I'm happy to be wrong here because I don't want to see a bizarre, fractious coalition control the mother city, but I think the DA is in jeopardy of dipping below 50%. They're going to need coalition partners in Cape Town because of what's happening there. And their lunch is going to be eaten in the Western Cape by the Patriotic Alliance and Gate McKenzie. No matter what McKenzie says or does, people seem to love him, especially in the colored community in South Africa. So they're going to hurt them. The Freedom Front Plus is picking up a lot of votes. People say it's from Black South Africans. I don't see evidence of that. I think that's a false flag operation. I've been encouraging that party for years when Peter Kernival was the leader, that they should go after Black voters because they're conservative. And so is the Freedom Front Plus. Just get past this nonsense of what Constantine Villon and what the party once was. It's not that anymore. But I think that we're going to see parties like the EFF disappear in KZN. They'll get virtually nothing in KZN. Their 9 or 7% is going to probably drop in many places, but they'll have places where they'll peak. Will they do well? The ANC is going to do poorly. The DA will not do as well as they think they will. The Freedom Front Plus will do better. The IFP will likely gain significantly in KZN. And I think that the big winner in this is going to be Gate McKenzie's Patriotic Alliance. Herman Mashaba has said enough absolutely ridiculous, idiotic things on Twitter that people have begun to take notice. And I think that Action SA has ruined their chances of surging. They might do okay in Hong Kong, but that's it. They're not going to do it anywhere else. They're not going to do anything. There's some fantastic candidates out there, though. Some really good candidates. In PE, the DA's got a great candidate standing. In, of course, Hermanus, where they're going to win, Clinton Larum, a brilliant businessman and a fantastic human being, is going to be the next mayor there. So I think that the, and of course, I think Helen, you know, this is what I have to say about Helen Zilla, of course, who offered to come on my program a few years ago and hasn't been on yet. But anyway, not that I'm bitter about it. But
I'll put in a good word, Chris. Don't worry.
Well, lots of people put a good word, but her moat dragons always keep her away from me. Anyway, but so Helen, I think she's courageous. I mean, you know, I mean, she's a go-go. She's in her 70s now, and she's still got the energy. She's out there swimming in potholes, double in the pothole. I love it. But yeah. She is, like Peter Carnevale, taking a poison chalice. I don't know how she can fix Joburg. It needs to be broken into multiple municipalities. I don't think it's manageable the way it is. She will make progress if she becomes a mayor. And if the polling from the Social Research Foundation is accurate, which it has been on many occasions, if it's accurate, the DA is way out in front. But 42% isn't enough. It has to be 51%. Otherwise, you have to make deals. And if people get angry and they don't get what they want, like what happened in PE when Athol Trollope was a mayor, then they break away mm-hmm. from your coalition and the government collapses. The concept of having a parliamentary system at the local level is the dumbest thing since the concept of Absolutely. Communism came along.
Yeah. Say it again, because people need to understand how dumb that is. We should have individual candidates in wards that are elected by the people who live in that particular neighborhood, so that they know who their person is. That's how local government should work. It's ridiculous that it's the same system we use nationally.
It's not just the corruption and kleptocracy and the ignorance, the arrogance, and the ineptitude that have caused the collapse of South African municipalities and its peristatals. Its municipalities have also been collapsed because parties use the municipal council for personal gain and privilege and party attention, not for service delivery to the people. There are exceptions. Athol Trollope, I've interviewed him many times. I'm not sure he's also a very good guy. The whole thing with Action SA, that's where he's at. But he was a brilliant mayor, of that town, which was falling apart, was turned around in less than 9 months. And then the EFF, which in the coalition, betrayed it. And then the ANC took over again. The whole thing fell apart. Look, I mean, South Africans, listen, go to the polls. Yella Lista. Go to the polls and vote. And then if it doesn't work, then you can complain. But if you don't go vote, you know, you don't need many votes in this election. Trust me, no one else is going to rock up. If you rock up, it'll make a difference. Also, I noticed in 2020 municipal elections that the Independent Electoral Commission had done some funky stuff and changed people's voting locations. I have people that have voted in the same polling station for over 40 years, and they were told they're not a voter there. They had to drive 50 kilometers somewhere else. Check your polling station before the election and make sure you're registered in the right place. All right?
That's exactly right. And you know what? Again, you will get the government you deserve. Or worse, as you said at the beginning of this conversation, if you allow all the other people who have nothing better to do or are lazy or are paid by the party to go there, given a free T-shirt, then you'll be ruled by not only people that other people voted for, but by people who are idiots who vote for the dumbest person they can.
Yeah, and people who are in it for themselves. Listen, Garth, the thing is about leadership is that there's a phrase, and I don't know if it came from faith or it came from military, where it came from, but it's a standard I live by, a servant leader. When you lead, you lead. Last night I had a meet and greet. We had 100 people rock up in Northcliffe, and I spoke for, 4 hours, walked around the room, engaged everybody, and people kept saying, sit down, relax. And afterwards, people are like, you know, aren't you tired? I'm like, yeah, I'm tired. But leaders lead. We do the things that have to be done. Well, if it's moral, right, and just, we do what has to be done so that the message gets across, so that things improve. And that's what South Africa needs, servant leaders. I think Athol Trollope, I'm not here to promote Athol Trollope, but I think that guy's a servant leader. And Helen Zilla in her heart probably is too. I mean, I think she's like that. There are some really good people here, and there's great people in a lot of parties. But the problem is when the parties pick the candidates, you don't really get to know the candidates because they're campaigning for the party, not for themselves getting office and what they're going to do for you. And I hope that South Africans begin to take control of their government, because you're getting the government that you voted for, or more likely, you didn't vote for.
A lot of people are commenting on your magnificent beard. How much maintenance and grooming does that require on a daily basis?
There's no beard oil, and I brush it once in the morning, and that's it. I trim it periodically. Of course, during I grew the beard because of COVID. So during COVID, I've been in Japan for the Rugby World Cup. The last month of active service, I actually went on my term. And then from one day to the next, October 1st, I was now on my military ID card. So I was in Japan, and we had Typhoon Hagibis, which cost me one of my games, my 18 games I was attending. I couldn't go to it because it was canceled. I couldn't shave for a couple of days because I was rushing from hotel to hotel in the rain. And then I came back to the States, and I had this, like, you know, George Clooney look. I went to the Army War College because I hadn't got paid my retirement check. I'm like, hey, where's my money? Show me the money. I haven't been paid. And they're like, in the end, somebody transcribed my bank account, which the Army's had for 40 years, and left one number off my bank account. So it was a fictitious bank account. That's why I didn't get paid my retirement pay. Anyway, yeah. And so, yeah, it's meatheads. It isn't done electronically. Yeah, the active force is electronic, but the retired force, it's anyway. So I had to go take care of that. And people are like, hey, that's a nice beard. And then my mother had cancer. So I drove to Ohio to visit her. And being respectful, I shaved. It was clean shaven to see my mother. And then I came back and I hadn't got paid the next month, 2 months in a row. I'm like, where is my money? And when I went back, I visited some colleagues at the War College, and I didn't have the beard. Like, where's your beard? It looked really good. So I started growing it. Then boom, the COVID scam started. And I said, I'll cut it when they start acting like adults. During the COVID scam, my beard reached my navel. I look like Rip Van Winkle. And the problem is this, Gareth. At the time, my hip wasn't damaged. It was damaged, but it wasn't. It got very serious where the cartilage is gone. But I walked every morning for an hour and a half to stay fit for my heart, my cardiovascular system. And I walk in the evenings and run 3 days a week. And I would walk in wintertime. I always wear shorts because the cold doesn't affect me. I would wear a hoodie and a cap if it was below freezing. But I walked in shorts, there's snow, and I cannot stand rubbish on the road. So I would pick up aluminum cans, crush them, put them in a bag, and walk along. So many people stopped and said, sir, do you need a ride somewhere? Can we help you? People thought I was homeless because of my beard and I was wearing shorts in the wintertime and picking up aluminum cans. I guess they thought that's how I was feeding myself.
You must have looked exactly like John Fetterman.
No. I got a head of hair. He doesn't have a head of hair. But So when I came to South Africa, I left it about mid-chest, my first tour in 2022, and then I shortened it up. Look, I'm not a fan of the beard. Really, I'm not. It's not my thing, but people love it, and it's kind of become like, everywhere I go, I'm recognized. I was sitting in Somerset West Mall at the Starbucks, and 14 times in less than an hour, people stop. Hey, it's a colonel. They all come over and greet me. People on the Valley of Desolation up on the mountain. Hey, Colonel, what you doing here? I mean, it's everywhere I go. Even Beaufort West. This guy Beaufort West is like, you look very familiar. I think I've seen you on TikTok.
You're a proper celebrity in this country. I bump into people all the time who say to me, oh, please tell Chris Wyatt, you know, we say hello. So how long are you still here for?
I'll be here until September. I've still got a few weeks left on this tour, and I've still got quite a ways to go. I'm in Gauteng now. I'll be going to Limpopo for the first time ever. I'm going to go to the Witkoys site and also have a meet and greet up there and then stay overnight. And I'll come back down this way. Every one of my tours has a theme and a title. My first title when I came back in 2022 is that I'm not a garden boy. That was my tour. Of course, you may remember that Ian Cameron and Becca Chilling. And so everyone has a anchor event. The anchor event for 2022 was the Sevens World Cup in Cape Town. Then in 2023, one of my trips, the anchor event was Steve Hofmeier's concert at the Parle Monument, or the Tell Monument, which was canceled because they backed out of the contract. So I went to Velvedoc. This one is the Colonel's Back in Town is the theme. And the anchor event is rugby's greatest rivalry. I am attending 5 of the 8 All Blacks games. I've been to the game in Cape Town, which was awesome for 67 minutes. And then I started crying, but it was pretty good for 67 minutes. And I will then have the Bulls at Loftus on Saturday. I'll have the Springboks at Ellis Park, and I'll have the Lions at Ellis Park. And then in Baltimore, I'll be back for the round out, this last Springbok game against the All Blacks in Baltimore. So I come back to Gauteng, then I'll fly to KZN for 3 days. I'll come back up here overnight, fly to Upington for 3 days, back here, then spend about a week in Western Cape before I head back.
Incredible. I mean, the amount of ground you're covering now, I think that there are people who travel professionally who don't have as much of an insight into South Africa and the various little hidden corners of this country. It's always good to see you. And I cannot say how much I enjoy your stuff that you post. It's terrific. It's insightful. It's to the point. There's no bullshit. You back it up with facts. You speak to people all over the place. So you have firsthand information. And it's just terrific. So if anybody is not following the Colonel, then you need to do this. Go and see what he's up to, because it's really worth doing that. Gareth, you guys should chat more regularly. This has been a very interesting stream, says Just Another Girl. Well, we try to do that every Friday, but when you have a guest like Colonel Chris Wyatt, it's easy to do. So thank you.
Yeah, no, I think the hint was that maybe we should talk more often. But we talk periodically. We could come on occasionally. In fact, last year, Gareth, as you remember, when President Trump announced the refugee program, 2 hours after he did that, I was live. And I stand by every analysis and projection that I made in that last year. And I only knew about it for 2 hours. And then I actually ended my broadcast after nearly 4 hours because I contacted you because you were coming on. I said, hey, this just broke. Do you want me to talk? And you invited me on. We talked for an hour. And then I went back and started another stream, and I was on until 4 o'clock in the morning. I had over 50,000 people turn. And the thing is that for South Africans, when I first went live, it was 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, but the Bush Telegraph works. People saw that I went live and they started calling all their friends and neighbors, and I had 38,000 people show up on that live stream. It was insane in the middle of the night.
No, you're doing great stuff. Thank you so much for your time today. It's always delightful to see you, and keep on keeping on, Colonel. Thank you.
My pleasure, Gareth. All the best to you and your viewers. God bless and have a good day.
Very, very good. There's Colonel Chris Wyatt, and you can follow him. We'll put all the links in the description of this episode. Wow, it's been an action-packed show this morning. So we've had Ben, we had Munya, we've got Chris Wyatt. It's just been tremendous. And that is it for this Friday morning. Keep warm over the course of this weekend, and we will see you next Friday at exactly the same time. If you haven't already, go and check out our daily briefing while it's still free, because it's not going to be free forever. And we want you to go and at least have a sample before you decide to subscribe, which is going to happen very, very soon. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Lovely to see you. And we will catch up next Friday. Be good. If you're not, take photos. Ciao.